This episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey is brought to you in part by Milk. Keep listening to discover how milk adds more to your day. Now, here's the show.
The amazing Kate Casey.
Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. It's been a full week of reality shows, and in this week's episode, I'm going to cover a lot. I spoke with Luke Hawksworth, who appears in the first episode of Netflix's unique dating show, Dating Around. Now, each episode of the series follows one person going on five blind dates. I asked Christy Cuthbert, a mother of triplet boys, to review Three Identical Strangers, a 2018 documentary which examines a set of American triplets born in 1961 and adopted as six-month-old infants by separate families, unaware that each child had brothers. The separations were done as part of an undisclosed scientific nature versus nurture twin study to track the development of genetically identical siblings raised in differing circumstances. You've got to watch this one. Jacques Peterson is an American music and entertainment reporter, and we cover not only Married at First Sight Australia, which is an incredible show, but also the difference between Australian and US reality shows. But my feature interview this week is with Kathy Kleiner. In the early hours of January 15, 1978, serial killer Ted Bundy entered Florida State University's Chi Omega sorority house through a rear door. Beginning at 2:45 a.m., he entered the rooms of Margaret Bowman and Lisa Levy, who did not survive their attacks. In an adjoining bedroom, he attacked Kathy Kleiner, breaking her jaw and deeply lacerating her shoulder, and her roommate Karen Chandler, who suffered a concussion, broken jaw, loss of teeth, and a crushed finger. Kathy, who later testified in his trial, described seeing only a silhouette of a man wielding a club. Tallahassee detectives later determined that the four attacks took place in a less than 15 minutes, within earshot of more than 30 witnesses who heard nothing. Kathy was 20 years old when she was attacked, 22 when Bundy went to trial, and 32 when he was executed in the electric chair at Florida State Prison on January 24, 1989. Kathy's attack has been mentioned in countless TV series and documentaries about Ted Bundy, including most recently Conversations with the Killer, the Ted Bundy Tapes, a documentary television series on Netflix. Yet Kathy has only come forward in the last year to tell her story publicly. I was enormously grateful she allowed me the opportunity to speak with her about not only what happened to her that night in January, but about her will to survive in the aftermath. The human psyche has a tremendous capacity for recovery and even growth. And Kathy's story is a testament to the importance of anyone who has experienced trauma embracing the irrefutable reality that it's not your fault. The experience does not define you, and you can move forward and live a very happy and full life. As I told Kathy, I will never forget our conversation, and I'm hoping that if you have experienced trauma, that this interview also helps you begin your journey to recovery. So now, here's my interview with Kathy. You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. So you were born in 1957 to Cuban-American parents, and you had quite a health scare when you were a child. In fact, doctors said that you wouldn't live past another year. Can you tell me about what diagnosis that you had? Because it's just such a crazy story.
When I was in sixth grade, toward the end of my sixth grade, I became very tired and had a fever all the time and just didn't want to do anything. So my mama took me to a pediatrician who also noticed I had a rash, a scaly rash on my face, which was a very good sign of having lupus. I went to another physician in South Miami, and they did diagnose me with systemic lupus erythematosus, which is actually a worse disease than lupus. It attacks your organs on the inside, where lupus is more of autoimmune blood and that kind of a virus, or that where there is more with lupus, it's regular blood disease. And with the one I was diagnosed with is one that settles in your organs. And in my case, it had settled into my kidneys. While I was diagnosed with the lupus, it was the end of my sixth grade. In summer, I was in the hospital for 3 months. I was given experimental chemo. I lost my hair. I was very scared at that point. I didn't know. I was in a hospital for 3 months, and doctors and nurses were coming in and out all the time. My parents and my sister stayed with me. However, it's not the same as being at home and having your family. I was to have my kidney removed, and the night before surgery, I had my aunt and uncle and a lot of my family, who were all Cuban, come into my hospital room. And we did a laying of hands, and they prayed for me and were there several hours. And I just laid on my bed and was felt like I should be open. I just opened up to anything and everything that they were saying for me. They left, and the next morning I was to have my surgery. However, the doctors tested my kidneys and found out that they were working perfectly, that both kidneys were at the regular stage of working and producing what they needed to. So that did cause my surgery to not be done, and I got to go home soon after that. When I went to high school, I joined theater, and I loved it. It was great. I wasn't the sickly little kid. I was, you know, Joan of Arc or whomever I was pretending to be. So that was a wonderful time in my high school years. After that, I was accepted to three colleges in Florida. And as I mentioned, my parents were very protective of me, first being Cuban, second having to help me through lupus and just taking care of everything I did and making sure I was taking care of not sick and protecting me. So when it was time for me to choose a college, I chose FSU.
And so you pledged Chi Omega. Your parents convinced you to move into the sorority house sophomore year because it had a house mother and locks. And that's really the irony, is that your parents thought being in this house would be safe.
Yes. When I was in my fall of 1977, I had become an initiated sister in the spring of 77, which was wonderful. There were about 40 sisters within the sorority at that time, and it was just a great time. I loved being there. I lived in a dormitory, which my mother hated. It was an all-female dormitory, so she didn't think it was safe. Anyone could come in, so my father and my mother arranged it that I could move into the sorority house in the fall of 77. Now, there weren't that many rooms upstairs. There might have been 20 women that lived in the sorority house. My parents said, move into the sorority. It's a lot safer, and we won't have to worry about you. There's someone on premises, your house mother, and there's locks, and people will watch you come and go.
So what we know of Ted Bundy is that he rented an apartment about a block away and spent a month there and probably was casing the house. Do you know much more than that?
He would act as a student on campus and do activities as a student would on campus. At that point, he was also collecting credit cards from different men that he met, and actually had several credit cards when he was caught and leaving the state. But by getting so many cards, he could be different people. It had been a while since he had killed anyone. So I think at that point, he was living in the apartment, that he was really starting to look out for someone that he could attack.
So tell me a little bit about the night of the attack. I understand that you and your roommate, Karen, were up until about 10:30.
Yes, I had gone during the day on Saturday, gone to a wedding and a reception at the little church I attended. And it was great. It was a sweet couple. She was training to be a nurse, and he was in engineering. So just a great couple. So after the reception, I did go back to the sorority house and I had to study. So I stayed in my room, sat up and just did my studying as well as Karen. She was studying and we were just quiet with, you know, quiet music and doing our homework. Around 10:30 or so, we both decided to go to bed. So we turned off our lights and went to sleep.
And then he broke into the house at about, I believe they say it was 2:30 in the morning.
That sounds about right. Bundy was actually at a bar, which was a couple, maybe a block away, a couple houses away from the sorority, off campus. So he was dancing and asking people to dance with him at the bar. And I understand that some people did and other people just said, no, you know, he creeped me out, she said, and didn't want to dance with him. At one point, one of the sorority sisters left the bar and was walking back to the sorority. He went out of the bar and followed her, not knowing where she was going or who she was. He was probably planning an attack where he could kidnap her. As he followed her, he noticed that she went to the back of the Chi Omega house and opened the back door and just walked right through. There was a combination on the door, but it had been broken for a couple days. So when he shut it, it didn't lock. It just closed. When he saw the sorority sister walking in, he followed and he stopped on the stoop to go into that door. There was a pile of firewood that we had cut up for our fireplace. He stopped and picked up a log and walked into the sorority house just as the other sorority sister had, without any locks being on it. He went up the stairs in the sorority. Now, the sorority was a beautiful southern mansion. The front doors opened up, double doors, to the beautiful sorority house. You open the doors, beautiful wooden staircase that kind of swirled around to the second floor. Beautiful plants and everything in the front foyer. Now, I lived on the second floor of the sorority house. So in order to get to our room, you had to go up those beautiful wooden staircase. When you walked to the platform of the stairs, right across from you is the bathroom. So now Bundy is standing on the platform, or the level of the stairs brought him up to. And he looked down the hall and there was a row of rooms, maybe about 10 rooms on each side of the hallway. Bundy, in my mind, was really just thrilled that he was in there and just that he had such easy access. And now he was going to see what he had access to. So he unscrewed the lights, the light bulbs and the lights that were lining the hallway. He unscrewed them enough so that the light went out. So as he walked down the hallway, he unscrewed a couple of the light bulbs. So it was really dark in there. When he, the first room he encountered was Margaret Bowman's room. He went in and attacked Margaret. She was beautiful. She was a young woman who, she was just beautiful and well composed. It was a senior and just had the world by its toes and just excited. And, he went in and attacked her by, he strangled her. He raped her and killed her. And then he left her in the bed and put the sheets up to her neck so it looked like she was sleeping. He then crossed the hall and went into Lisa's room. He attacked Lisa, bludgeoned her, strangled her, and also bit her on her buttocks. And actually, that bite mark would come to haunt him, because that's one of the way they identified him as the only person who could have made those bite marks by the molding of his teeth. After he attacked Lisa, the next room was across the hall, was our room, room number 8. I remember I was sleeping on my left side of the bed, and I actually heard the bedroom door open. And that kind of woke me up a little bit. But what really woke me up is when this person tripped on that little trunk that was between our beds. We had about 3 feet between the trunk and each of our beds. He tripped over that, which put him right in front of my bed. And I remember seeing this dark shadow, this dark form of someone. And he lifted his arm up over his head. And I remember seeing he had something which turned out to be a log in his hand. And he threw it down and struck me in my head, in my face, my head, my shoulder. And it didn't feel like a sharp pain. It was more like pressure, like a thud. And as I think about it now, I think it should have been like, you know, pins and needles, but it wasn't. At that blow he gave me when he hit me, he shattered my jaw. I almost bit off my tongue, and he slit my cheek so wide that it from my mouth to my ear just flapped open. After he did this to me, he heard Karen, my roommate, walking around. Waking up and moaning, and starting to understand that someone was in our room. He then went over to her side of the bed and beat her. Again, he beat her with the log about her face and caused her jaw to be broken as well. When he heard me still alive, I was in my bed and in my head. I was screaming and yelling for someone to come and help me. But all I was doing was making just little sounds because I had my jaw was not working, my tongue. I had all this blood coming out. And I didn't, when I was sitting up and holding it, it just didn't register what was happening. Bundy came back to my side of the bed because he never left a victim alive. That was one of his things he was proud of himself, was never to leave someone alive. So when he came up back across to my side of the bed, our room faced the back of the house, which also faced the driveway. At that point, someone was bringing home a sorority sister from a date. When they came through the parking lot, the light shone up into our bedroom, and they were bright. They were illuminated the room so bright. And I think as he stood there attacking me, he thought he was seen, because at that point, he stopped the attack and left our room, which then I understood he went down those beautiful stairs and out the front door, which stopped him from attacking anyone else that night.
It's like a divine intervention, really, that somebody...
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Pulled up at the right time.
I do believe it. Yeah. Yes. I mean, and to show the, you know, when your eyes are closed, you can tell if a light's on in the room or turns on. It was bright. It was really bright. And I remember opening my eyes and, you know, seeing the room lit up and seeing this thing that was leaving my room. And I believe at that point, I just lay down and passed out a bit, because that's the last thing I remember, seeing him walking out of my room.
So did you wake up the next day in the hospital?
Actually, that evening, right after he left, Nita Neary was the sorority sister that was coming home that night. She saw him from the side leaving the house. Her first thought was, oh my goodness, one of the sisters had a guy up in her room, which is totally uncool. So she walked up the stairs, and right at the landing, right there was the bathroom. She went in and said, you know, one of the sisters had somebody in her room, and it was weird because he was carrying an umbrella. They came out of the bathroom right when Karen was stepping outside our door. So our door was very, very close to the hallway, and her bed was right close to the door. When she went out in the hallway, the girl saw her, and because the hall was dark, they couldn't turn on the lights. They just turned her around and walked her back to her bed on the side of the room. Then they saw all the blood and how she had been just attacked very brutally. They looked over and saw me sitting up in the bed, moaning and holding my face and blood everywhere. So at this point, they called 911, and it seemed like forever I was sitting there, and they were trying to console me, and it was just a blur, just kind of a confusion state. But I do remember when the paramedics came up, and they came into our room. One was working and helping me and the other one helping Karen. The paramedic that was helping me, just moaning, and he says, "Hush, it's okay, honey. You've been shot in the face. We're going to take care of you." I'm like, you know, I believed I was shot in the face because I didn't know. And he said that because the way my cheek had flapped over from my the corner of my mouth to my ear, he thought it was a bloodshot, a gunshot wound. So seemed like forever again. Everything seems slow motion when you're in a situation like this. But I remember he put me on the gurney and strapped me in and took me down the staircase out through the front doors. And I remember laying on the gurney, looking up toward the sky, and all these heads were looking down at me. I saw like three or four heads just looking at me. I, you know, still out of it, not understanding. They walked me out into the night, and there were police cars and the fire trucks and the ambulances, and there were lights everywhere flashing and red and blue. And I almost felt like you're in a carnival situation because the lights and everyone's talking and everything's going on around you. And I remember thinking that quite often, that state of mind I was in took me to somewhere I was familiar, somewhere I knew that I could be comfortable in. So I think that's why my mind took me to the carnival scene. I was then put into the ambulance and taken care of and went to the hospital at Tallahassee Memorial Hospital.
You woke up in the hospital. You had to have your mouth wired shut. How long did it take you to recover from the injuries?
I was in the hospital for about a week. When I was first taken into the ER, I was taken in the operating room and had my jaw wired shut. But before that, I remember I was in the emergency room scared. At this point, I'm confused and scared. And there was everyone around me. And again, they didn't know how much trauma I had had, if I had been raped or exactly what had happened. Being scared and seeing all these faces, I looked up and there was my friend who had just gotten married that day. She had the night shift at the ER. So that just made me feel so much better. She came down and kissed me on the cheek and said, "Everything's going to be okay. We're taking care of you." At that point, I could relax and, you know, understand that I was okay and I wasn't going to get hurt again. This is a good place to be. So they took me into the operating room and wired my jaw shut. I then went into my hospital bedroom and stayed there about a week before I was allowed to leave the hospital and go home and recuperate at home. When I left the hospital, though, that day, the police took me back to my sorority house. And they wanted me to go upstairs and look at my room to see if anything was missing. So each step I took, that beautiful staircase became agony, and it wasn't as pretty as it used to be. I had police officers on each side of me helping me walk up the stairs, which I took one by one, very slow. I got to the landing on the staircase, the second floor. I went down the hall. I looked down, and the first thing I saw was Margaret's room. Her door was shut, and there was crime scene tape, yellow tape around it. I then turned my head, which was Lisa's room, and again, the door was shut with crime scene tape. I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything of what had happened, totally what had happened. When I got to my room, it had a lot of crime scene tape on it. They moved the tape and let me walk in, and it was horrific. There was blood everywhere, on the ceiling, on the walls, all over my beautiful bedspread that Mama had just gotten me in December for moving into the sorority house. It was a beautiful white and green. I love my bedspread. And to look at it at this point, it was just covered in blood. It was crimson and just a mess. And as I looked at the walls, it seemed like someone had a big paintbrush with red paint and just splattered the walls. It seemed to be that much blood on it. They asked me to look at my tall dresser, which was in the corner, to see if I had anything missing. And all I could see was the black dust that they used to fingerprint, to lift fingerprints. I looked at that and just you know, couldn't tell if anything was missing. And then one of the officers asked me if I ever used red nail polish to fix a run in my pantyhose. And, you know, I thought that odd. And I, you know, of course, said no. So then I was going to leave the room. They turned me around. I looked back and I saw my bedspread. And it's funny how in a time like this in trauma, you see little things that mean a lot to you. I love that bedspread, and it meant something to me. And when I saw it so messed up and so bloodied, that made me sad. You know, it's the weird things that happen to you. And of course, not knowing about Lisa and Margaret having been killed, that I didn't know that. So I was sad for my bedspread. After they took me into the sorority and left, we left and went to the airport, and I was flown home back to my parents' house in Miami.
Did you ever go back after that to the house?
Yes, I did. About 2 years later, we were, some friends of mine were going up to Florida State from Fort Lauderdale to watch a football game. And as we drove through it, I said that I wanted to stop by the sorority house. And just because I needed to, I wanted to. And they said, well, we don't want to go. We'll leave you at this, you know, at the street, and you go, and then we'll come back and pick you up before the game. Oof. And I said, all right. So they left me off at the street on the corner, and I walked very slowly down that little walkway to the front of the doors. And again, it must have taken me an hour just to take those baby steps. I opened the door, and it was different. The sorority had redecorated, it was so different inside. It didn't look like the same house. However, those wooden staircase were still there, beautiful as ever. So every step I could take, I walked toward the staircase, and one of the new pledges came through and said, can I help you? You know, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm a Kayo. So they said, okay, and walked away. And I went up those stairs and went to my room and opened the door, and it was totally a different room. It made me feel good that I didn't see the blood everywhere and my bedspread messed up. Now it was different. Now I could move on from that spot I was in my head, because it wasn't the same as it was, and I was not the same as I was when I left that room the first day.
Didn't you tell anybody who you were?
No, not at that point. Not at that point. I just left. I was in my own bubble. I was in my own mind. And I looked around. I didn't see anyone I knew. And when the pledge asked me, you know, I said, I'm a sister. So no one came up to me in particular to talk to me.
Did you keep in touch with anyone from that time, particularly your roommate, Karen, or any of the sorority sisters?
Right after I went home from Tallahassee, I went back to an oral surgeon, and he had to re-break my jaw because it wasn't aligned correctly. He put pins in my jaw up at the ear, up the ears, and then he had to wire my jaw at the chin, wire it together because it had been shattered so bad. So about 3 weeks after I got home, he had to re-break my jaw and align it, and I was wired shut again for another 9 weeks. So as I went home now in Miami, in my parents' house, I heard a lot, and I wanted to hear from my sorority sisters. And this is about less than a month after the attack. And I would go in the kitchen and call them, and someone, one of the pledges, would answer the phone, and I'd ask for someone in particular, and they said, well, they're not here right now. Let me take a message. And no one ever called me back. What? So after a week or so of this, Mama said, you don't need to keep doing this. No, I will. You know, they're just busy. They'll call me back. So after a couple weeks, I knew that no one was calling me back because I left enough messages. And I think I stopped at that time trying to reach out. But I think when I was calling and wanting to talk to someone, I needed to hear them say it wasn't your fault. You didn't do anything wrong. You were just there, and we worry about you. We think about you. But no one ever talked to me. No one has ever contacted me from the sorority since then.
When Ted went up the stairs, were there any other rooms that he tried to get into because he went into Margaret's, she was the first one to be harmed. But were there other women that had perhaps locked their doors and he just couldn't get in? Was there any indication, like, did they hear anything in the hallway and they looked out and they saw him and they got scared and closed the door?
I don't believe so. I believe when he went up the stairs and went to the first landing, that only thing in front of him was the restroom, our big bathroom. If you look to the left or to the right, there is the hallway, both looking the same on each side. We feel that he just turned and went into the first room he saw, which was Margaret. Now, she was home, and she was alone in the room. Her roommate was out of town that weekend. So I think he just found it too easy to walk in and to strangle her and to rape her. And at that point, he went across the hall to Lisa's room. When he did that, and he was, after he attacked her and killed her, or assumed to have killed her, strangled her and bit her, he then came out of that room and just walked across the hall to our room. He was kind of zigzag. So being in the front of the hallway, we don't think he went to other rooms because they would be further down. And he would have tried to make entrance, I think, to other doors along the way.
Oh, my gosh. Were any of you provided counseling? I would think that the school would have some sort of responsibility, if not the sorority's national chapter, to provide you guys with some help.
I don't know if the sorority sisters did receive help. I do know that there were a couple that had the why not me syndrome, the survivor's syndrome, and obviously they needed to be taken care of and helped more. None of my sisters contacted me during that time afterwards and since, so I didn't have a chance to ask if they were getting help, and I'm sure they were at some point, those that needed it. I'm sure it was there for them if they needed to use it.
I would assume Margaret's roommate has had, you know, the difficulty too. I mean, for all of you, it breaks my heart because I have daughters, and to think of what your parents collectively went through, especially your parents, especially Margaret's parents and Lisa's parents and Karen's parents, it's just, now that you're older and you have a child of your own, does your heart break for your parents too?
Oh my God, does it ever. Now this is going to get me. My parents had to deal so much with me, with my lupus, and take care of me and make sure I was healthy and doing the right things and everything they could do to make me survive and to keep going. The love and the support they gave me for me to join the sorority, and they suggested I move into the sorority house and live in the house instead of living in a dormitory that they felt was not as safe. And for them to make that decision in the fall of 77, I moved in the house, and then in that January, I was attacked. I can't imagine. I just can't imagine the horror they went through and the pain. And the last thing I ever wanted to do was to cause them pain. They never spoke about it to me, and it just didn't ever seem a time to bring it up. But I know they've had to really had such turmoil inside. I do, since I do have kids now, I know that you get very protective of them. And having a son, I think he was then turned around to be protective of me. I remember when he was around 2 years old, I had just gotten divorced from my first husband. We were, Mikey and I were in our condominium in his bunk beds. I was sitting on the bed with him and giving him love so he could go to sleep. He looked up at me and touched the scar on my face and said, "What is this, Mommy?" I said, a long time ago, someone came into my room and hit me, and he hurt me. So that's why we always have to keep our front doors and our doors always locked and the windows locked." And he looked up at me with his little eyes and said, "Mommy, I'll make sure no one hurts your face again."
Oh, man.
And that was the sweetest thing. And over the years, he was very protective. If I went out at night, he would like, "Okay, when are you going to be back?" He was worse than my husband and taking care of me, and his friends did as well. We were in Mobile, Alabama, and if I'd go out to do things, they go, "Okay, Mom Kleiner, where are you going?"
Did you ever end up graduating?
No, I did not. When I left Tayo and FSU, I lived in a time as recuperating and learning to be self, confident again, and just wanting to move on with life. And to me, going back to college or Tayo in particular just wasn't anything I needed to do at the time or anything I wanted to do. So I did not graduate, but I have gotten a life degree in everything
Certainly.
I've been through.
Were you panicked at all in the time between the attack and when Ted Bundy was caught? Were you ever worried, you know, he might come back for me?
I actually was not. I was in Miami at my parents' home. It was a smaller house. We did have a police officer that sat at the front door of our house, and there was one across the street in an unmarked car. We were on a cul-de-sac on a corner, so actually there was one that kind of drove around the house periodically in and out of the neighborhood. I felt safe all the time. I mean, you know, no one was going to get in there with my mom watching me and the police officers. You know, I did not at any time feel afraid that something may happen again. My mama used to go to the officers and say, "Here, have some lemonade." You know, so she was always the one out there and talking to them. And I just stayed in, and I wasn't afraid of them, of anyone coming back. I was afraid, though, of as I got my mouth unwired and I could speak again and learn to be out in public, it was disconcerting for me to kind of understand that not all men came into my room and not all men hurt me. I didn't see his face, but it was still a big, bad blob. And even though I read as much as I could at that point in the early months, no one knew it was Ted Bundy. We didn't know who it was. We just knew that somebody had attacked us in the sorority house. So I felt very safe at my house in Miami with the officers standing outside.
Did it surprise you after you went to the sorority house that you just walked in, that this horrific attack had happened, and here you are 2 years later bravely walking in, and that no one sort of asked who you were?
No, they didn't. Like I said, the pledges were walking around and just doing what they did. And I walked into the sorority house after about 5 minutes of walking 10 feet it was terrible. It was hard for me to walk in. But yeah, no one asked who I was. No one cared. No one knew anything. You know, I was just someone there. And I think if I had stopped and said, you know, who I was, I'm almost thinking the pledges wouldn't have even known, because one of the reasons the sisters were not talking to me and not talking and contacting me was that the Chi Omega sorority, the main office, told the women of Chi that as long as I was in the picture and they kept in touch with me, that I would always be known as the girl that was attacked by Ted Bundy at the sorority house. So by not keeping in touch, then the pledges would want to come and pledge the sorority. But not doing so, the association wasn't making any money by no one being pledged. So I understood that was the reason why no one contacted me in the early years. And then people move on with their lives. I mean, you know, I was in my little world, and I'm wondering why everyone isn't focusing on me when they were in their lives and graduating and moving on. So, you know, and they wanted to forget me, as they were told. They just wanted to forget.
That was such an enormous mistake on their part, and they should be ashamed.
I'm sure when I left Chi-O afterwards, I'm sure the sisters had therapy given to them, the option. I'm sure they did, because actually, one of the sisters committed suicide right not far after the attack, and not knowing the whole situation, if it was brought on by the attack, she obviously had some other things that were in her life that she couldn't cope with. But a lot of people said that she had the survivor's guilt, and that just broke my heart. I mean, broke my heart, because, you know, we try to survive as much as you can, and then not to be able to handle that it wasn't you that was attacked is just, that just breaks my heart. And I know that, like I said, the women just did what they were told, but it doesn't make up for any of it. It really doesn't. The women, it just doesn't make up, you know, it just doesn't. I'm sorry. I can't say that enough because of the hurt they caused me. And I just wanted to hear their voices and for, you know, them to tell you didn't do anything wrong. We're here. We did this today. We did that association. We went to that frat party. I just wanted to know what life was still up there, because in 2 seconds I was brought home and cut off, and I wanted to know what was still happening. And I didn't have that. I didn't have that piece of information that I think would have helped me heal.
But you're an extraordinary person, because I read that 3 months after this attack, you took a job as a cashier at a lumber yard, and you did that for a specific reason. Tell everybody why.
I was at a point where I was moving on, but in my head, I still had anxiety about men. They had caught someone who they said was the person of a suspect. And that didn't mean all that much to me, because, you know, usually you catch a couple suspects before you narrow it down to, you know, for the police to get the correct one. So I became anxious about men I didn't know, men's faces, just who they were. Was everyone going to attack me? What was I going through? So in order to get over this, I did go to a lumber yard and worked as a cashier for a couple of weeks, maybe a month or so, until I understood not every man's going to attack me. That's where I saw the most men that I did know in a fast time, that it kind of cured me or got me over that fear that, yeah, no one, you know, not every man's going to do this to you. You know, it's just that one guy. So that really helped me heal also at that point.
That was smart. You have had so much stuff happen in the year since this attack. So you were robbed at a bank. You had numerous surgeries for TMJ. You survived stage 2 breast cancer, a miscarriage. You are really a spectacular person. And I have to think that first experience as a child with lupus set the tone for you. You were obviously born with what I like to call a survivor chip. How do you think that you've been able to walk through life with such courage?
I think that's a good question. People ask me all the time. And I did it because that was in me. That's who I am. That was my soul to be like that. I after lupus, and I was homebound for that 1 year, I knew, you know, I'm not going to do this. This is stupid. You know, I'm not going to have to stay anywhere for the rest of my life in somewhere that I can't control. So I think that helped me with lupus. And then with the Bundy as well, I was attacked, and I didn't want to be known as a survivor, because I healed. I got better, and I went on in life, and I thrived in life. I enjoyed it. So again, not feeling sorry for myself. But one thing I do remember as a healing process was I'd be afraid. At night I'd have my scary points. And I thought to myself, if I just walk 1 foot forward, that means whatever I'm scared of is 1 foot behind me. And as time went and I took those steps, I couldn't do it all in one day. It just took me maybe over a week or 2 weeks to take one step. And in my mind, I erased 1 step behind me until I could get through it. And I still had anxiety, but it wasn't, I was scared of it. I had controlled it. I had pushed it behind me. So again, I think that was a coping mechanism that I used, as well as, you know, just having love of the family and knowing I was going to do this. I was in control now. Bundy controlled me, and Bundy had controlled all the women that he killed, but he wasn't in control of me anymore. This was going to be my journey, and I was going to live it the way I wanted to.
Did you pay attention? Were you watching television the day that he was electrocuted in 1989?
Yes, I did watch it during the years, right after the attack as well. I would read anything I could about Bundy. I would watch whatever was on television, and I wanted to know him as a person. even though he only showed us what he wanted us to see. Again, he was a control person, and he just let out what he wanted people to see. So by doing that and understanding that he was a man, a very sick man, who was capable of doing these horrible things and yet put his persona on that he was a good guy, that I found fascinating. I just found that so unique and so understanding that I could understand it and know that he had the two different sides of him. So as the electrocution was going on that day, I was in my apartment with my fiance. I had a son, and even after lupus, they said not to have children because it could reactivate it. I had a beautiful baby boy, healthy, and so I had my son at my mama's house. My fiance and I were sitting on our sofa in the living room when they had announced that it was done. I actually got a call from the district attorney saying it was over, that he was dead. And then we saw it on TV like minutes later. I just took it all in. I had a deep breath and I cried and I cried. And I thought of Margaret and I thought of Lisa and all the other women. And I just let it all out. I didn't cry for myself. I cried for them. And after, I don't know how long it was, I got my composure back. I sat down and took a deep breath and told my fiance, I'm hungry. Let's go to breakfast. Because at that point, I had gotten rid of all the nastiness that was in me for all that time.
What do you think about all of the attention on Ted Bundy? Most recently, there's a new movie coming out with Zac Efron. What do you want people to learn from this?
I haven't seen the film yet, so I don't know. Well, I understand they're going to pick an actor who plays and looks the part of Ted Bundy because they're trying to make it as real as possible. So by getting an actor that looked like him, portraying his story as he saw it and as he wanted it to be seen, I don't know if it glorifies him or just brings it forth that, you know, he was a good looking man and, you know, had everything going for himself, but he was not in control as you watch further down in his life. I hope that this movie does show the victims more, how they each had lives and dreams and wanted to do things, and Bundy killed them and took them away from the world far too soon than they should have been taken. So I just hope that the movie does it justice, shows the part of Bundy because that's what he was and who he was. But I also hope they go into the survivors and talk about them more as people that were human and beautiful women.
Absolutely. My hope is that we replace so many stories about Ted Bundy with the story of Kathy Kleiner, because it's really so inspiring to hear how you've moved through life. And if there's one thing that you want people to listen and to know about you, or maybe perhaps for the person that's listening to this and has experienced trauma, what do you want them to know today? As they're sitting in the thick of it and they ask themselves, like, how do I need to move one foot in front of the other? What is your advice for them?
They need to look inward to themselves. Everyone has a strength that they are born with that they don't even know about. It's a strength that will help pull themselves out, pull themselves to the point where they can take baby steps. And once they find that strength, no one can take it away from them. They're going to be in control again. They need to open up and look at the situation, understand it, and get on top of it. Become in front of it instead of hiding behind it. One thing, when I had breast cancer, I was stage 2. I had a radical left mastectomy. I was on chemotherapy, and I had like 9 months of chemo. I would go, my husband would pick me up, and we'd go sit for hours, and I'd be sitting there just, it was painful. It wasn't a good time. He would bring a game. We'd play a game for a little bit. But after that series, I had one more to go through. And he's like, no, you have 7 more. I'm like, no, I have one more to go through. And when I go through that one, then I'll have one more. because if I thought of it as having nine of these treatments, I that would be too much for me. So in my little mind, I told myself I had one treatment, and that's the way I continued until I finished my chemotherapy, because that got me through it. You know, I didn't look at the big picture. I looked at the small picture, where I could take my baby steps and take care of myself and move on.
That's really great. Well, I am so glad to have met you, and I don't think I will ever forget this conversation. And I hope that we keep in touch. And I'm so grateful for the time that you've taken and so inspired by your story. So I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much for contacting me. I appreciate it. And I love to tell my story, and I love to get it out there for people to hear. And I really do hope I can help people, like you said, that are in the thick of things, to know that, you know, they have the strength to get out of it. They just have to find it. And it might be really far down. It might take them a while to find it. But like I said, once they pull it up, that's the beginning of healing.
So if people want to reach out to you and just say hello, or to ask you advice, or just to find out more information about you, is there a way that they can contact you?
I'm on Twitter, and it's Kathy K. Rubin is my handle, or whatever they call it. That's the way they can reach me. But if they do just Kathy Kleiner, that'll find me as well. And it's amazing how many people have reached out to me, and I try to answer as many as I can, you know, personally, even if it's just a couple words, to let people know if they open up to me and ask me to help them with advice, and I do help them, that they can go forward instead of just talking and leaving a story and then, you know, having no response. It's like, you know, like normal, they didn't get a response. So I want to try to help people as much as I can that way.
Green Chef is a USDA certified organic company that makes eating well easy and affordable, with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. I know that you're looking for a meal delivery company, and some of us, like myself, have a lot of dietary restrictions. It's sometimes pretty hard to find someone that can fit into your wheelhouse. That's why I love Green Chef. They let you choose from a wide array of easy-to-follow lifestyles with select organic ingredients. Recipes are quick and easy, with step-by-step instructions, chef tips, and photos to guide you along. And I gotta tell you, the photos are a big help. With Green Chef's wide variety of high-quality, clean ingredients, you can feel great about what you're eating and how it got to your table. They've got a diverse array of meal plans with plenty of options. I'm telling you, plenty of options to choose from each week, so you can actually enjoy sticking to your goals this year. For example, I choose from the paleo diet. So this week alone, I've been able to get Caribbean spiked pork chops and Thai coconut chicken soup. Not only delicious, but so good for you, and with really good ingredients. So for $50 off your first box of Green Chef, go to greenchef.us/reality. That's greenchef, greenchef.us/reality. Hey, if you're busy like me, you know the first step in any beauty routine is just to find the time for it. I mean, let's be real. For most of us, a 20-step full face of makeup every day is just not going to happen. Makeup should give you maximum impact with minimum effort, and I just discovered a beauty brand that finally gets it, and that's Wander Beauty. It's a line of multitasking beauty essentials that are easy to use and travel friendly, so you can get ready in, get ready for this, 5 minutes and stay gorgeous on the go. Did you know it was founded by a working mom of two and a supermodel? So two women who are always on the move and know how to make the most of their precious time. Wander Beauty completely streamlines your beauty routine with fewer products that work better. And that means being more thoughtful about the stuff you do use. Wander Beauty is clean, cruelty-free, and made with ingredients that your skin will love. And they've already won a ton of awards, including Allure's Best of Beauty Award, and has fans everywhere. It's time to make your morning with Wander Beauty. Get 20% off your first purchase at wanderbeauty.com/reality. Wander is spelled W-A-N-D-E-R. So wanderbeauty.com/reality for 20% off. wanderbeauty.com/reality. Netflix has a fantastic new show called Dating Around. I'm somewhat obsessed with it now. It's got a really tantalizing simple premise. Six single people go on five first dates.
this season and the first episode, which starred Luke Hawksworth. He is a New York-based real estate agent, extremely cute, and he went on 5 very interesting dates, and I've tracked him down in New York. Luke, how are you?
Hey, Kate. I'm doing amazing. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
So tell me how you found out about the show first.
Yeah, so it was actually really random. I was doing some traveling this past summer, and I get back and I'm in such high spirits, and a girlfriend of mine who's a casting agent, she reaches out and she says that something came across her desk and they're looking to fill a spot for this particular part. And she tells me what it's about and says, you know, we need someone to go on dates with 5 different women. We'll pay you this amount. Everything will be taken care of. And I look at it, I'm like, wait, you want to pay me to go on dates with women? I was like, I'll do that for free. So I guess I was immediately interested in it. But filming was going to be in like less than a month. So just did, you know, the interviews for it. One thing led to another. And I got greenlit for the show. So just really just by chance and through a friend.
Before you go on a TV show, this is a question for, as a woman, I can imagine the stress of like, okay, I got to lose some water weight. Do guys think like that too?
I don't think I ate for 3 weeks. I lucked out though, because I had just been traveling and I was, you know, out, on the beach a lot. So I felt great. Like I was, you know, sunny and tan and, I've been running a lot, but yeah, it was kind of, I definitely wanted to look my best. So I think I was like in the gym twice a day before the show, just trying to prepare for it.
I appreciate your honesty. Now the restaurant, you went to the same restaurant for every date?
Yeah, we were. So, I mean, they basically, they use the same restaurant. We wanted to keep everything looking the same. I mean, everything that I wore, my outfit was the same each night. We tried to keep the meal that I had and like what I was drinking the same. So, you know, everything was supposed to be the same except for the different girls. And that's, they just wanted to make it so it was fluid with how, whenever I would ask a question to get the different responses from the different girls, but have the background and everything else look the same.
That makes sense. Did you choose the restaurant or did they choose the restaurant?
No, they chose the restaurant.
Will you?
It was fantastic. I'm really happy with it.
Will you ever eat at that restaurant again?
Yeah, totally. I have actually. It's called Sumai. It's a Thai restaurant in Brooklyn.
So you show up to the first date. Who was the first person that you went on a date with?
So Victoria was the first, was my first date of the series, and each one was filmed on a different night. So, yeah, she was the first one, and I guess I was a bit nervous, to be honest, starting this. So she made it a lot easier because Victoria is super outgoing. She's a lot of fun. She doesn't really have a filter, and it threw me off guard a little bit, but I think it helped me loosen up and kind of be myself a little bit more and have fun with her.
Did you tell the producers the kind of girl that you're looking for and they came up with the selection of dates for you? Or did you just go into it and say, I'm open to what you want to set up for me?
Yeah, I think the producers had an idea of the type of girls that they wanted to introduce to me. And I did tell them what my type was and what I'm currently, or, you know, what I was looking for. But also, I think they already had them picked out when they found me, because I was sort of like last minute. Like, it was like 3 weeks away from filming when they found me. So I think they had most of the girls already picked out. But I think it was in line with sort of the experiences that they wanted to have people see, because in New York, it's really diverse. Like, you meet all types of people. So I think it was a pretty accurate show of the different people that you meet or are set up with, and how dating is in New York.
Of the women that they chose, which one was most aligned with the kind of woman that you typically date?
I'd say it's between Victoria and Kate. Actually, I really did like Kate. I think we hit it off pretty well. And, but it, like, there, for some reason, just wasn't like a big spark with us. So I think that's why I ultimately picked Victoria. Victoria was just so much fun. I wish they could have shown more of our experience on our date together. But yeah, we just had a blast together. But Victoria, she's more aligned with the type of girl that I normally date.
Was there anybody that surprised you? Like they sat down and you thought, there's no way this is going to work out. And then by the end of the date, you thought, I actually might go out with them again.
To be honest, no, not really. I think I was able to kind of tell, like some first impression how it was going to go. And I think, you know, each date kind of stayed pretty consistent with how I thought it was going to go. So
the woman that was late to the date, who left the restaurant and said, I'm getting my car and it'll be great if we're friends, but let's be honest, there's not a match. Was that as uncomfortable for you as it was for the people watching?
That was super uncomfortable. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Ashley's so sweet. I just really, from the time she sat down, we looked at each other, and after we spoke for a few minutes, she was like, you know, I don't think that we're very compatible, or this, you know, you're typically not the type of guy that I usually date, but you seem really nice. Let's make the most of this. And so really most of our conversation, they didn't show too much, I guess, from the conversation we had. We were able to get good content as far as like explaining more about me and some questions from her too. But from the beginning, we were, I mean, honestly, like most of the date, we were showing people on our phones, other people that we'd be interested in, like that were our friends, and like trying to set each other up. But the last scene with her getting into her Lyft, was very awkward, because she, when she called her Lyft, like I didn't know where this Lyft was picking her up. So like, I think I stopped, and it's just like, I didn't know what to do. And so I look completely awkward, which I hope was funny to the viewers, but, yeah, it is what it is.
What about the kissing scenes on the streets? Did you look back in horror? Were you embarrassed by it, or does it make you laugh? And what about your family? Are they like, what were you doing on television?
Yeah. So I had a viewing party at my place with like 50 of my good friends over. And so those two parts were definitely the hit of the viewing party. And so, I mean, it's so funny, because obviously, you know, the lip smacking part where Tiffany is just like being hilarious, and everyone's looking at her lips and all that. And then, you know, we walk out, we make out outside the restaurant, and people are like, oh my gosh, like, what are you doing? Like right after like the lip smacking part, and people were kind of cringing super hard at that. How the episode kind of unfolded in that way, like I definitely felt embarrassed. My family, they were just laughing at it. Like they understand, you know, it's like we were on a date, like things happen. I'm actually, you know, really attracted to Betty. She's sweet. After like dancing with her outside the restaurant too, it just felt kind of natural to do that. And I liked watching that scene. I think it was nice. So.
Yeah, I could feel like your older sister friend that you had a lot of sexual chemistry, but it never would never go past that. So that was hard for me to watch, because I was like, Luke, why are you wasting your time? Have you ever seen her on a run in Central Park since then?
No, I haven't.
Do you know why? I think that she lied when she said she was a runner. I think she just said it to try to make herself seem more interesting to you. I feel like I've watched enough episodes of The Bachelor to kind of know when people are telling the truth. And speaking of The Bachelor, don't you think you'd be fantastic for that show?
Oh my gosh. Everyone's been asking me this, and I don't know. I don't know if I'd actually do it.
So you went on a date with Victoria a couple more times, and then it kind of fizzled out. So right now you're single and ready to mingle.
That's right. I am very single. After things kind of, you know, didn't pan out with Victoria, I just kind of took some time to reflect on the dates and, you know, just decided that I kind of wanted to be single for a little while. You know, I obviously, knowing the show was coming out, I was anticipating how it would be once it was released. So Yep, I'm single. I'm ready to mingle. and yeah, that's where I'm at right now.
And you told me the other day that your DMs are on fire. Has this show opened up the dating pool immensely?
Kate, it's insane. Like, I didn't, I expected there to be something, you know, like this that's coming, but I mean, literally thousands of DMs. I don't know. It's too much for me to go through, and I'd love to respond to people, but it's just way too many. I don't understand how like influencers or people who have like a large following can handle it, because it's so much. It's overwhelming. It's also, it's very flattering. Everyone has been so nice. People said to, you know, prepare yourself for the negative feedback too. And like, surprisingly, I haven't seen that much. But for the most part, just very flattering and super nice. And everyone's been really, really sweet.
Well, I'm voting for you for the next Bachelor. When people are Google stalking you, where can they go to find out more information with the hopes that they walk past you on a New York City street, you lock eyes with them and ask them to go for a nice Thai dinner?
Yeah. I think the best place is my Instagram. It's just at Luke Hawksworth. That's the best place to find me. Feel free to shoot me a DM, but I can't promise I'll be able to get back to you. But yeah.
What if they
feel free to follow me there.
What if they want to buy a nice condo in the Bronx? Is that in your wheelhouse too?
I do most of Manhattan. So if you're looking to buy or sell your apartment, that's totally something that I can help you with in the city. And I would be happy to.
And by the way, you did work for Ryan Serhant. So there is a chance that maybe the producers of Million Dollar Listing might hear this too and consider you for a spot on that show, wouldn't you say?
Maybe so. I've been on, when I worked with him, I filmed for like an episode or two with that. And maybe they will hear about me. I would love to be on that show. Actually, it would combine two things that I really enjoy. So if the producers are listening, then give me a call.
I think I mentioned it last week. I've been fascinated by a new documentary that's on Amazon Prime right now. It's called Three Identical Strangers. It's a 2018 documentary which examines a set of American triplets born in 1961 and adopted as six-month-old infants by separate families, unaware that each child had brothers. The separations were done as part of an undisclosed scientific nature versus nurture twin study to track the development of genetically identical siblings raised in differing circumstances. Combining archival footage, reenacted scenes, and present-day interviews, the documentary reveals how the brothers discovered one another at age 19 and thereafter sought to understand the circumstances of their separation. I was so excited when Christy Cuthbert, who is a San Antonio, Texas-based mother of fraternal triplet boys and a mother of four, all boys, reached out to me and said she was equally fascinated by the study. And since I don't have triplets, I was really eager to hear what she thought of it. So first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kate. Happy to be here.
So tell me how you found out about it.
I had just read an article or seen a news blurb that it was going to be at a film festival probably about a year ago. And then sometime maybe late summer, fall 2020, actually did an episode on it before the movie kind of went national. And that was compelling enough. It had the triplet brothers, and it also had a few sets of twins that they had reunited, you know, and they kind of delved into more of the Louise Weiss agency that took place in the study. And, as a mom with multiples, I was just fascinated to find out, you know, how these people turned out, what the similarities were, what the differences were.
Something that really surprised me is that these triplets were separated at 6 months. So there was a definite bonding. And in part of it, you will see in the documentary that they mention how they all acted out in some physical way as children. Some of them banged their head against the wall. Can you talk to me a little bit about what it's like to have triplets? Because it's like totally beyond my wheelhouse.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the most fascinating things to my mom and I as well. We almost wondered, like, what kind of difference in infancy would they have had if they were split right at birth versus having those 6 months together. You know, probably back then in the 60s, they were probably all three sleeping in the same crib together, real close every night. Where nowadays, you know, if you're having triplets, you're likely going to be in the NICU for a few weeks and they're going to be in separate isolates, or they're going to be in, you know, some people will co-sleep twins and triplets. Mine ended up, you know, each having their own cribs when they got home. But, you know, during that first year of life, and even now, they just share this bond. And I, you know, they're in the womb together for, you know, mine at least 8.5 months. And they just, you know, even now at 5 years old, I'll walk in the room and they're all sitting on the couch. You know, we have a big living room with two full-size couches. They'll all be literally on top of each other on the same couch, on the same cushion, watching TV together. So there's just this, you know, this closeness there that, you know, they love their bigger brother, but there is just this bond between them that, you know, at five is unbreakable. You know, time will tell as they become adults and life change. But yeah, that was one of the craziest parts to me, was that they waited until 6 months to split them.
At the direction of a prestigious Jewish adoption agency and psychiatrists Viola Bernard and Peter Neubauer, the three infants were intentionally placed with families that had differing parenting styles and economic levels. So they had one blue collar, right, one middle class, one affluent, and that each family had already adopted a baby girl from the same agency 2 years earlier. I wondered,
right,
what it was like for those sisters, because they did make a point of the film of saying that all those the triplets became quite close once they were reunited, and that the other families, right, they considered them to be brothers, but they didn't really mention much about the sisters. You have another son. Does he feel,
yes,
left out ever?
You know what? That's something that my husband and I, have worked really, really hard on to make sure doesn't happen. I mean, from the day he was, you know, from the day they came into the world, it was, we need to place this emphasis on John, my oldest. And when he was really young, and, you know, we'd do an outing to Target with three infants and carriers, and here's my, you know, 3.5, 4-year-old walking aside, you know, it's like you're a circus sideshow. Every lady in Target wants to come up and oogle over them. And we were just very, you know, oh, this is their big brother, John. He's the best brother in the world. And we've always made it a point to make him feel special. And he has, I mean, he is the greatest big brother to them. And, you know, a star in his own right in our family. We just go above and beyond to make him feel special. And, you know, they're getting to an age now, the triplets, where it's time to start making each one of them feel special and different. You know, they still love to dress the same. So, you know, just this morning we were out at the rodeo and they're in matching Texas sweatshirts and cowboy hats, and they love it and they love the attention from it. But as they're getting older now, you know, this nature versus nurture thing, they each are incredibly different in their own way. You know, they're a team, they're a pack in many respects, but their personalities are so different that as they're aging now, you know, they're wanting to do more of their own individual things. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I was also surprised watching this that the people that were in charge of the study would come and visit with them, I think until they were their age of maybe six, periodically, and just observe them and take copious notes. What did you think as you were watching that, imagining your own triplets being observed in that same way?
It was bizarre. And they took a while in the documentary to say what the line was that they told the adoptive families as to why they were going to come and do this. But that would just be so odd to me. I don't know. I'm such a tiger mom. Like, I would start questioning why it was needed. I would want to see results. But, you know, this is a different era. And, you know, it's an adoption circumstance versus, like, these are my own children. But, you know, I mean, we've had people, you know, triple little boys, all blonde, blue-eyed, walking around town together. You get people just whipping out their cell phones and filming them and taking pictures of them. And it is super bizarre. We have, you know, had to go above and beyond and kind of placing parameters on it. And it's terrible because sometimes it'll be, you know, a nice little granny like, my daughter has twins. Do you mind if I take their picture? And we've had to say, sorry, we just have this family rule, because there are those people that will, you know, walk by and start taking pictures of them. And, you know, they're just little kids trying to walk around and do their thing.
So if you want to watch this, you can also do some further research. There's a 1995 New Yorker article by investigative journalist Lawrence Wright. And if that name's familiar, it's the same author that wrote the expose on Scientology. So he's a great reporter. The same never-published twin study was the subject of a 2007 memoir, Identical Strangers. It's written by the twin girls that are also in the documentary.
and the subject of the 2017 documentary, The Twinning Reaction, followed by the 2018 television episode, The Secret Siblings. And today, there is a joint development project, a dramatic feature version of Three Identical Strangers, with the documentary's director, Tim Wardell, as an executive producer. So this will be a movie. Will you watch the movie?
Absolutely. And, I was reading some articles after I watched the documentary where people are just demanding a sequel. Like, there's just got to be a way to get these archives released because the brother, he ended up committing suicide because they felt he suffered from manic depression. This whole movie was like a manic depressive episode. You know, it was the highs of them meeting and how glorious that was of them all falling in love with each other and finding each other. And then the sadness and the hardship of finding out they were lab rats, essentially, in a study. And, you know, by the end of the film, you're looking at those two remaining brothers and they just look sad. You know, there's just sorrow in their eyes. And, you almost, when they were talking about like why they won't release it, you know, they believe there's still sets of twins out there that don't even know they were part of the study. And how awful would that, you know, rock their world? You know, I don't know. The whole thing is just incredibly sad. But yeah, I'm completely fascinated. And I wish, you know, like they say in the documentary, I wish they would release the information. So at least, you know, they'd find answers or all of that they went through would be worth something in the end, you know?
So the results of the study are locked in Princeton University in their archives. And with the request from the person that began the study that they are not released to the year 2066. And they're trying to find some sort of loophole. And some of the documents are slowly being released. I wonder, what is in it that's so bad? Is it what you said, that there are other people that will find out they were separated?
I think that's part of the reason why they're not releasing it till 2066, is because they want anyone who is involved with this study to be long gone before they release the results. I also think when they did the interview with the woman who was Neubauer's assistant, she hints at the fact that there's a lot more nature than nurture than people want to accept. You know, we all want to think we have free will. And she hints at the fact that that might not be the case. And then when they show the families discussing it, they're like, you know, we don't need a study. We know it's all nurture. So there's these two, you know, I think as humans, we want to believe we have free will and we make the decisions on how our lives unfold. But she hinted at the fact that that wasn't necessarily the case and that people might not be open or ready to hear something like that.
It's so interesting. So tell everybody where they can find you.
Sure. So I'm on Instagram at Christie Cuthbert. It's a mouthful. C-H-R-I-S-T-I-E Cuthbert. C-U-T-H-B-E-R-T. I'm also at Facebook at Mom I Farted at Church. I'm currently writing a book about living in chaos with four little boys, and that's the working title of it. So y'all can join in on the fun over there.
Are you interested in investing but don't know where to begin? Well, Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. And plus, there's no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections such as 100 most popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moments to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of Reality Life with Kate Casey a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at reality.robinhood.com. With 4 daughters and 2 on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house, but I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging.
I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you gotta get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris New Panorama Mascara. You're gonna love it.
Jacques Peterson is an Australian music and entertainment journalist and is responsible for my current obsession, which is Married at First Sight, Australia. Now, I mentioned it on last week's show. It is much better than the American version. There are way more couples. They have cast a collection of batshit crazy people. My favorites are, of course, Sam and Inez. Inez is the Bosnian refugee, and Sam is a quote-unquote model. And they are currently having an affair, which is borderline amazing. Jacques, thank you for what you have done to my life. Thank you for your attention to my need to see fantastic reality TV shows.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people don't know about how great Australian reality TV is. I mean, it was really bad for a really long time, and kind of in the last 5 years, it's really picked up. Like, I don't know if you've watched Real Housewives of Melbourne, but I watch all of the Housewives and I rate it up there as probably like the second best. And, you know, Married at First Sight, it's better. Our version of Survivor is better. So, yeah, Australia has a lot of really great reality TV that just doesn't get much shine internationally, unfortunately.
Well, that's about to change. Now, have you watched Yummy Mummies?
Oh, my, you know what? I actually haven't. That show aired here, right? And it was a huge flop. Like, no one cared about it. They moved it into a really late nighttime slot. And now I know that it's on Netflix and everyone started watching it now and talking about it. So that's really funny to me.
What about Instant Hotel?
That is another one. Okay, so Instant Hotel came out here. It flopped. No one cared. And now it's been picked up on streaming. And I hear that people in America are obsessed with it. So it seems like people in America like latch onto our reality shows that don't do well over here. Whereas the shows down under that are like huge juggernauts, like Married at First Sight Australia, nobody knows about.
What American reality shows do Australians love?
Well, Kardashians is really big here. Like Kardashians is huge. Geordie Shore, and Jersey Shore, but I would say, Geordie Shore is actually bigger. And, you know, Real Housewives, Bravo shows are quite big, especially probably Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, because Lisa Vanderpump is like quite popular down here, but Australia is really Kardashian obsessed. I mean, there's been a lot of times when the Kardashians have come down here and they have like exclusive products that are only available in Australia. So people down here love them.
What are there a lot of people in Australia who want to look like a Kardashian?
Yes, it's we've got that whole kind of like Instagram model look going here now where everyone is like plumping up their lips and they just look totally ridiculous. I mean, these are the kind of people that end up getting cast on Married at First Sight.
Tell me about the Australian response to the season of Married at First Sight.
Okay, this has been huge. This is like the water cooler show of Australia. I mean, everywhere you go, people are talking about this. I mean, just before I spoke to you, I was at the gym, and as soon as I went in, people are like, oh, did you see, you know, Sam and Innes last night on Married at First Sight? The ratings are enormous. I mean, I haven't really seen anything like this in years, like probably since like Australian Idol down here was like a huge thing. I mean, it's just one of those shows that wherever you go, everyone's talking about it. It really is kind of on another level.
Do they love Sam? Like, who are the favorites? Is it Elizabeth?
People love Elizabeth because they feel bad for her. I'm the only person probably in Australia that loves Innocent Sam. I think they're hilarious. People are having a really, really strong reaction to her. Like yesterday in all of the gossip mags that said that she's become a recluse and that she's lost weight and that, you know, she's scared to go outside because of the backlash. I mean, here in Australia, this happened last season as well. There was a woman named Davina. She kind of played the Innes role. She had an affair with her husband. She was probably the most hated woman in Australia for about 6 months. So yeah, I'm usually the only one that's a fan of these people because I think they're having a lot of fun with the show. I just don't think that most people watching get it. They take it probably a bit too seriously. I would love to see her go and sort of do the rounds on other reality shows. The thing is that with the network Channel 9 that airs Married at First Sight, they have these really, really airtight contracts where you can't work for any other networks for like 2 years, and they're really strict. So even if she got interest from shows, you know, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and, you know, Australian Dancing with the Stars, things like that, I don't think the Channel 9 would let her do it. So she'll probably fade away, unfortunately, which is such a shame because, I mean, she's such a gift. When the show started, it mirrored the American Married at First Sight, where, I mean, it still wasn't as serious as the American version because the marriages were never legally binding because we have a law here. I don't know what it is specifically, but just legally you can't marry someone that you've only known for 30 seconds, like America. So the marriages were never legal, but they did take their job more seriously early on. And then as the show progressed and the more kind of salacious moments were the things that were bringing the ratings and getting people talking, it just kept going further and further to the point that I would say they mismatch maybe like 9 out of 10 couples, and then they do one really good match so viewers can kind of be invested in that love story. This season, the love story is Cam and Jules. They're really sweet. She's a men's barber, and she's pushing 40 and she's desperate for a child, and he's like an adorable cricketer who always put cricket over love, and now they're kind of their head over heels for each other and obsessed with each other and doing these kind of like lovey-dovey pap shoots where they're, you know, shopping in the supermarket and giggling animatedly for the cameras. So people really love them. They're the love story. Everyone else is just a complete train wreck, and that's thanks to the experts.
So how long ago was this filmed, and is that couple still together?
Everything I've heard from my various little gossip sources around the place tell me that they are together and they are actually in love. Seeing them do these weird kind of stage paparazzi shots in the last few weeks, I've been thinking, oh, are they fooling us? But yeah, everything I've heard that they're actually together. The show finished filming around December. I think that's when they do their little reunion, which is always crazy. So they're definitely together. And there's one other couple that I think are together. It's a Greek woman named Martha, and she's a Kardashian clone. I mean, she has literally had plastic surgery to look like Kim Kardashian. And they matched her with just a really kind of just this really hot guy. They look like a bachelor couple, you know, this sort of your standard generic bachelor couple. That's what they look like. Apparently they're still together, but I'm pretty sure every single other couple from the show is over. And actually in the history of Married at First Sight, we're on the sixth season now. There's only one couple that's still together from season 2. Every other couple is kaput.
Now, also, Australia was the first country that had, was it on The Bachelor where the two women fell in love with each other?
Oh, yeah, that was so fake. You know, that was so annoying to me watching how that got picked up by media across the world, because they were totally faking that. That was such a publicity stunt. And, you know, it worked like a charm. It was amazing because one of the girls for the Bachelor girls that was in that lesbian relationship, she got off, I think she got out on like episode 3. She had no airtime. Like, she was one of those Bachelor people that you never see and is just completely irrelevant. And then when she did that, they got so much attention, and people were like, oh, you know, isn't it beautiful that these two women found love? And I'm just thinking, oh my God, it's a publicity stunt. Like, they're Instagram models and they did the cover of Maxim magazine down here, like a lesbian Maxim shoot.
Okay, well, how can people track you down? And by the way, the two of us are talking about Married at First Sight Australia on Twitter all the time. So if you want clips, if you want suggestions, if you want insight, Jock has like good intel. But if they want to track you down to find out other stuff about Australian reality shows, where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm Arcady Blog on Twitter. So it's ArcadeyBlog. I used to have a K-pop blog back in the day. I don't really update it anymore, so but I still got the handle. I'm obsessed with reality TV, Australian reality TV, Bravo shows, UK shows. I'm just totally reality TV obsessed. So ask me anything and I'll be happy to talk to you, you know, for hours.
I want to thank my great guests this week, Kathy Kleiner, Christy Cuthbert, Jacques Peterson, and Luke Hawksworth. I want to remind you to subscribe to the iPod,
I want to remind you to subscribe to the podcast and to leave a 5-star review on iTunes. You can find my Facebook page at Reality Life with Kate Casey. Just put Reality Life with Kate Casey in the search button on Facebook. My Twitter is at Kate Casey. I am tweeting about shows and during shows throughout the week. And of course, my Instagram is at Kate Casey CA. And lastly, you can find my website at loveandknuckles.com. These days, getting to the things that really matter in life, they can be tough, especially with all the distractions and the pressures out there. But at the end of the day, the things that matter, the things that we really cherish, they're the simple ones. And dairy milk is oftentimes a part of those moments. Milk is simple, nutritious, and fresh from the farm. Milk is part of moments that shouldn't be taken for granted. A latte with a friend, sharing a favorite recipe around the dinner table with friends or family, or a comforting glass with milk and cookies after school. This week, my kids have been off from school, so we've been making a ton of recipes. For example, we made British trifle the other day with fresh whipped cream, and today my daughter Mia is making fresh vanilla donuts with vanilla glaze, and all with fresh dairy milk. Take a moment to savor the moments that really matter with milk today.
Listen to the 48 Hours podcast for shocking murder cases and compelling real-life dramas from one of television's most watched true crime shows. Go behind the scenes of each episode with award-winning CBS News correspondents and producers in Postmortem, a weekly deep dive. Listen to 48 Hours wherever you get your podcasts.